And 1 Kings and 2 Kings were originally one book. And it tells a story just after King David has, it's the end of his life, and then there's a long line of kings after that, hence the name Kings. So we're going to be reading from 1 Kings 17, and we'll read the whole chapter. And there are really three stories in this chapter, so yeah, pay attention for those three. And we'll work through them in a few moments. Chapter 17. Now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word." And the word of the Lord came to him, "Depart from here and turn eastward, and hide yourself by the brook of Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith, that is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening. And he drank from the brook. And after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Arise and go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel, that I may drink." As she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." And she said, "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. Now I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." And Elijah said to her, "Do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me. And afterwards make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth." And she went and did as Elijah said. And she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill. And his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And he said to her, "Give me your son." And he took him up from her arms and carried him to into the upper chamber where he lodged, and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn, by killing her son?" Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." I wonder if you have ever found yourself in a situation where you have thought, "Yep, I'm not getting out of this one. This is utterly hopeless." You ever felt like that? Well, my mum often tells the story of when I was just a little toddler. and I was not even walking. And she was doing that mum thing where you've got various children around and you're trying to get out the house and carry your bags and do the pushchair and everything like that. And unfortunately, the one thing that she neglected to do was put the foot brake on my pushchair. And she turned around after locking the door, only to see me trundling away down the road towards a very steep curb. Disaster. So she turned around, only to see my sister, who had just started walking, running in the direction of a road in the opposite direction. I wonder if anyone could identify with this, but it was a bit of a superhero movie moment where she's got to make a choice. So obviously she chose my sister, and I ended up on my face. Now, obviously I lived to tell the tale, but what if the characters in that story really did have no hope? I'm going to put a photograph up on the screen, if that's okay. And it's one of the most famous photographs from the 20th century. It's taken on the 6th of May, 1937. I wonder if anyone knows the event I'm talking about. Well, if we just click along, it should come up. Is it going to work? There we go. This. The Hindenburg disaster. The German airship, the Hindenburg, caught fire when it was trying to dock to its mooring mast in New Jersey in the USA. And this photo depicts the moment where the gas giant plummeted to the ground with 36 fatalities and many more injured. And I wonder if for some of you this morning, that is exactly where you're at. You are cruising in the Hindenburg, headed for disaster, and your life right now really does seem a bit hopeless. Maybe work for you is just too much. Maybe your family life is a struggle. Maybe it's grief, or your marriage, or health problems, whatever it is. There are many, many things in our lives, aren't there, that make us feel utterly hopeless. And, you know, so often when we reach seasons like that in our lives, we so easily forget. We're very forgetful people, I think. We forget just how good God is and how faithful he has been to us over the years, perhaps. And it's like a veil or a cloud is covering our eyes and we just can't see through the mist from our hopelessness. And we fly into a sort of panic and into a hopeless fear. Maybe for some of us, we might feel angry or frustrated. Like, why is my life like this? Where are you now, God, when I need you? Well, as we come to this chapter, 1 Kings, we're going to see a different story. Yeah, we're going to see hopelessness, but we're going to see a God who is there. Endlessly and faithfully providing hope where it seems that there is none. Hope for the hopeless. And if I could just get that title up on the screen. It should come up in a moment. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. So, this passage is split into three stories. And each of these stories has two halves to it. Okay? So, look down with me. Verse 1, story 1. Now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead, said to Ahab. Stop there. We've got two characters here who will feature a whole lot over the next 8 or so chapters. Who are they? First, Elijah. You've heard of him. He's a prophet and his name literally means my God is Jehovah or Yahweh, the God of Israel. My God is Yahweh. He's a prophet and he's talking to our second character, whose name is Ahab. Again, you might have heard of him. You'd only have to flick back one page to see just how bad this guy is. He is one of the kings in this book who has moved so far away from God. In fact, in chapter 16 and verse 30, it says this, "And Ahab, son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him." And you know, Ahab marries this terrible woman. You might know her name, Jezebel. Jezebel, it sends a chill down your spine. And she hates God's people. She introduces these false gods, Baal and Asherah, into Israel as well. So you see what the storyteller that we're looking at here, see what he's doing? He's setting up these two characters. My God is Yahweh, Elijah, and Ahab, the idol worshipper and the puppet of a wicked queen. And there's a face-off. And this is verse 1. As the Lord, this is what Elijah says. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there will be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. Because you have rejected the living water, Ahab, your throat will be dry. You can't grow crops without rain, can you? You can't keep animals without water, like I was saying earlier. What will we eat? How will we live? And Ahab's thinking, how am I going to rule? And what I think makes this even more cutting, and actually a bit funny, to be honest, is that Baal is supposedly the god of fertility and rain. God knows what he's doing here. So you can imagine it wasn't the most popular of announcements. And to have a king hate you is a very dangerous place to be, is it not? A very hopeless place to be. So Elijah delivers this message, and perhaps things seem hopeless. Part 2, verse 2. God spoke to Elijah and said, "Depart from here. Quick, go now where nobody can find you, to the Cherith ravine." "Lord, nothing is there. How will I eat? How will I live?" Maybe these questions are flying through Elijah's mind, but God's already answering them in verse 4. "You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." So Elijah went. He hid in the place that God had prepared for him, and there he finds that ravine, and he sits there alone. Even the name Cherith means to be cut off. And he drinks from the brook and he waits. Waits for God to provide, to stay true to his word. Perhaps he sleeps after his long journey. And when he wakes up and the fear of his enemies returns, he rolls over and there on a rock is a bird, a raven, has flown through the night and brought him scraps of meat to eat. Maybe even taken from the kitchens of Ahab himself. And Elijah eats, and he's provided for. Bread was brought as well, and the brook cooled his tongue in the heat of the drought. So the Bible is so beautifully written. I don't know if you've ever appreciated that. The Bible is beautifully written. And I love the way that in verse 6, this storyteller uses repetition, really to hammer home the point about God's faithfulness. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. It's a repetitive thing, isn't it? And he drank from the brook. Feels a bit like that sometimes when I'm feeding my cat, faithfully providing food every day for her to come back and want more the next day. Day in and day out, God provides for his servant bread and meat, the most basic foods, aren't they, as well? A consumable blessing, manna from heaven in hopelessness. See how this story moves from what seems like a hopeless situation where God provides hope once again. That's the first story. The second story begins almost as hopelessly as the first. Elijah has now been in the Cherith Ravine for, it just says, some time. Days, weeks, months, doesn't tell us. But what we do know is that Elijah's one lifeline, the one thing keeping him alive, the brook that runs through the ravine, well, it dries up. And the last drops dissolve into the sand. Elijah realizes that the water has run out. And he realizes that the judgment God brought on Ahab now seems to be coming to him as well. But God is faithful, so the story doesn't end there. Verse 8. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there." I wonder what provision Elijah thought that he would get when he arrived. A powerful ruler, maybe, to defend him against King Ahab. Maybe a great amount of wealth or anything to provide for his earthly needs. Maybe. But God, as always, is the God of the unexpected. And he provides not through power or through wealth, but through someone else. Verse 9. "Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." Again, "I have instructed first a dirty raven, now a widow, a humble widow." So Elijah goes. And when he arrives at this gate, there is this woman there, dressed in widow's clothing, collecting in a basket the last of the sticks fallen from the famine-stricken trees. This woman is at the very end of her resources. At the very end of her resources. Maybe again, as Elijah sees this woman, he wonders how on earth God is going to provide anything through her. And then he sees in his mind's eye a raven with meat in its beak. And he remembers the God he's following. Verse 10, he called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And amazingly, this woman goes immediately to get some for Elijah. I'd love to talk about the woman here, but we don't have time, unfortunately. But as she's going to bring it, Elijah remembers the promise of food and, maybe a little bit cheeky, he says, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." And her response here is heartbreaking. Let's read it together. She says this in verse 12, "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour and a little in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." And once again, Elijah finds himself in what seems to be a hopeless situation. But that's not the end of the story, is it? That's not the end of the story. Elijah replies in verse 13, "Do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me. And afterwards, make something for yourself and your son." "But I've just told you this is all I have. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth." And she believes him. Amazingly, this widow who has nothing to lose, she takes this man at his word. We're not told why, but we do know that God has his hand in every situation in these stories. And against all odds, in all hopelessness, he is still working. Verse 16. "The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty. In fact," verse 15, "she and her household ate for many days." What a faithful God who looks deep into our needs and our fears and our doubts, and he provides us what we need. Perhaps that provision is sometimes difficult. Maybe it is. The Bible teaches us that sometimes God lets us experience hardship. Live in the ravine, if you like, for a time, so that we might grow and learn to trust in his unfailing faithfulness. And once again, in Elijah's hopelessness and the widow's hopelessness, Yahweh, God, provides hope. He provides life. He provides for his people. So the widow and her son ate well for the first time in months. Hope in hopelessness. One last story. Part one. Elijah stays with this widow and her son for some time. The next chapter seems to suggest it was around 3 years, but we're not exactly sure. So day after day, Elijah and this woman sit and her son sit at the table and eat in thankfulness for the food that God continues to provide for them. day after day. Perhaps Elijah had become as close as a father to this boy. We don't know. And then one day, we read in verse 17, after this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill. So this woman, who had already suffered the grief of losing her husband, now watched as her son catches a fever, loses his appetite, stops eating altogether. And it says his illness was severe. He was bedstricken. And there was nothing her or Elijah could do to stop the inevitable. They don't have medicine or miracle to heal this boy. And eventually, there was no breath left in him. His mother's arms around him, her life once again is thrown into hopeless despair. And as she holds her lifeless son in her arms, she turns to Elijah, the man that she thought had come to save them. And she says this, verse 18. She said to Elijah, "What have you got against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son. Did you come here with your bread and your oil and your God for this? To remind me of my sin and take my son away from me?" And he said to her, "Give me your son. Let me take him before God. I know he has a plan." Maybe you are in a season of your life right now that feels hopeless and overwhelming. A season of maybe suffering or of hardship or of grief. And maybe, like I said at the beginning, you've turned to frustration and to anger against God. Or maybe it's just a kind of helplessness, not knowing what to do. But if anything, this story shows us that even in the worst of the worst of the worst of situations that we find ourselves, there is still a God who is good and faithful and loves us and provides for us. He sees the beginning from the end. And he hates suffering, and he hates despair and sorrow, and his plan has always been to rid the world of these things. And it will be in the future. I've been there. A few years ago, I hit absolute rock bottom. And the stress of life just took its toll. And I never experienced anything like it before. My mind gave up. My body gave up. My health gave up. But you know, when I was in that ravine, God provided hope. And he provided a way out. And he provided freedom. He is a faithful God who gives and gives and gives again. Verse 19. Elijah took him from her arms and carried him up to the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed, on Elijah's bed. He lies the body of the boy on this bed, stone cold. And in verse 20, I think we see a glimpse of Elijah's mind, maybe of some doubt. Verse 20, "O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn or whom I'm staying with by killing her son? Have you brought me here for this?" And the response, silence. And we know there was silence because he carries on. He stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." Three times. You can imagine the scene, can't you? He prays once. "God, please let this boy's life return to him." Nothing. Once more, he throws himself over the child. "My God, let this not be. Let the child live, please." Silence. Elijah is desperate and he cries out one last time, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." Is there one more raven for this boy? And we mustn't think that God is defeated, because there is another part to this story. The Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and breath comes into the boy. And with a gasp, he wakes up. Elijah picks up the boy and runs down the steps to his mother, perhaps still crying upon the stone-cold floor in her grief. And I love imagining this, but as she looks up, it's the part of the story that we long for, isn't it? It's the part of the story that every fairy tale points to. The son is alive. He's alive, and he's returned to his mother, into her arms, and she believes. The woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. He is faithful and he is good." And this morning, these stories are a pointer. They're a pointer to an even more hopeless situation. And it's this. It's our tireless rejection of the God who loves us endlessly. Our tireless rejection of the God who loves us endlessly. He does. He created us. He breathed life into us. The Bible said he carefully knit us together in our mother's womb. He wants the absolute best for us. He's given us dignity and value. And yet we have turned away from that into a life of independence and selfishness and temporary pleasure. We have. All of us have done it in different ways. We prefer the drought rather than the river. We try to provide a fulfilling life for ourselves instead of relying on his simple provisions day to day. And if we're honest, sometimes we prefer this spiritual death rather than the life that he offers us. Free, wonderful, never-ending life. It's a hopeless situation, isn't it? Really? And yet God, in his eternal and selfless love, provides hope even in darkness. Even in darkness. And how does he do it? Well, God himself, he comes as a child. We've just spent a whole month celebrating that. He comes himself as a child and he grows up and he suffers and he dies. And as he dies, the Bible says that he bore our sin on himself. The judgment and the penalty that we rightly deserve, he took it upon himself. And as Jesus dies, death wins. But there's another part to this story. And it's no different to the ones we've been reading. 3 days after Jesus is buried in a stone-cold tomb, the boulder sealing him in is rolled away and he walks out. Death couldn't hold him, not even death. Where now, death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? It is finished. Christ has won, and we can now claim that life as our own. To live in him, to share in his riches. So wherever you're at this morning, whoever you are, the message of the gospel, the message of Jesus is this, that in the darkest night, there is a dawn to come. In the darkest night, there is a dawn to come.